Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys.
We consider ourselves kind of entrepreneurs first and social entrepreneurs second, and we want to make money out of this, and that's a kind of a key driver to what I actually believe has made us successful and will continue to make us successful. Anybody who has a mobile phone and has a little bit of cash as working capital to transact as float can essentially become an ATM machine and provide a financial service to all of people within their communities that can just walk up to them and then, you know, are able to move money from one part of a country to a completely different part of the country instantly.
Welcome to the first Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. In this podcast, I am very excited to be speaking to Mike Quinn, CEO of Zuna. Mike is an inspiring social entrepreneur with a mission to enable Zambians, wherever they are, to access cash easily, quickly and safely using mobile technology. Zuna works with entrepreneurs and small businesses to help stimulate economic growth, the key to economic development and progress. Zuna was set up in 2009 based on an idea in a text message. Today, it has a network of cash agents across Zambia and now processes millions of dollars in payment value each month for small businesses in Zambia.
So I should probably ask this question now. So can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you came to join Zuna, Mike?
Sure. So my story begins, I think, back in early 2000s, around 2002, 2003. I was studying mechanical engineering at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and I did the 5-year degree and I did it fairly well, but I wasn't really inspired to go kind of launch a career as an engineer, although I found it a very useful starting point and a good analytical background. But I was looking for something, I think, more meaningful at that stage of my life and got attached to a young startup organization called Engineers Without Borders. And they had a student chapter at my university that I got involved with in my last year. And then when I graduated, I applied for a volunteer placement in Africa with them. And at the time, I really knew nothing about Africa. I knew nothing about social entrepreneurship. I'd never even heard the terms before. But it was a very exciting prospect of going and applying my kind of newfound engineering knowledge and skill set to Africa to solve some problems. So I was sent to Ghana for a year, and I got to work on an agricultural project with small-scale farmers and integrate into the local community and learn some of the local language. And it was just such an eye-opening experience. And then when I finished that, I went back to Canada and actually did work as an engineer for about 6 months and really, having come from this exciting and project environment in rural Ghana to a kind of a corporate cubicle environment in Vancouver, I wasn't, you know, very inspired. So I bit the bullet and went back to Engineers Without Borders and said, can I do another placement? And then they sent me to Zambia for a year and a half, again, another agricultural project, but this time I was working more with local cooperatives that were marketing products as a business, and got involved in a little bit more business and entrepreneurial training. I then went and wanted to make a commitment to kind of international development as a career choice, and I was able to get into a master's degree program at the London School of Economics. So I did that for a year, studying international development, and then I got a big break where I had applied through an MBA program at the University of Oxford, and they had a social entrepreneurship scholarship, endowed by Jeff Skoll, who is one of the founders of eBay, and I was very, very fortunate to get the scholarship and then did the one-year MBA program, which really kind of opened my mind to business and more of entrepreneurial approaches to development and poverty alleviation. And I then had the skill set in more of a business training and background to do something about it. So when I finished there in late 2008, and then in early 2009, I was really itching to get back to Africa and kind of take the knowledge that I'd gained while studying in the UK, but apply it in an entrepreneurial environment. And I jumped on an airplane and went back to Zambia, where I had a good network, and I wanted to start a business working with local entrepreneurs and helping connect them to outside investment. And just got very, very lucky again through a chance meeting with two entrepreneurial brothers named Brad and Brett McGrath, who had actually started this company called Zona. It's a local word in Zambia that means it's real. And they had developed an early stage technology kind of based on what was happening in Kenya and the mobile payments industry, and had an initial business model and then a little bit of cash, but they were really just getting going. And I was introduced to them through a mutual colleague and just loved kind of the vision that they had and said, I can work with these guys. And it was literally the first day I landed in Zambia. And then, you know, I was able to help connect them to some early stage seed funding of about $200,000 to get us to the next stage. And over time, just, you know, became business partners with them, convinced my parents to mortgage their retirement home. They were retired teachers back in Canada, and lend me $100,000 to invest in the business. So I kind of jumped in head first, and then, you know, 5 years later, I'm still working with them, and we've been, you know, building the company since.
Wow, that's amazing, amazing story, and a real commitment you've made to Zona. It's very exciting. Can you tell me a little bit about Zona and you know, what exactly it does?
Sure. So Zona is a mobile payments business. We are primarily operational in Zambia, although our head office and all of our technology development is done in Cape Town, South Africa. And it's kind of emerged as our hub over the last couple of years, and is giving us a platform where we're hoping to expand into other countries in Zambia. But we fundamentally help micro and small enterprises grow. That's the main core purpose of our business. And in countries like Zambia and throughout Africa, micro and small businesses that are, you know, typically mom and pop shops, they have challenges making payments to their suppliers. They have poor access to capital. The banking system isn't providing them with a lot of services, and they're often interacting with a mass market consumer segment of just regular people that are buying things through them or sending money transfers or you know, transacting at like every day at these local stores that don't have bank accounts or access to financial services. So in Zambia, I think 80 plus percentage of the adult population has never had a bank account, doesn't have any access to credit cards and debit cards and things that you would have in a Western environment. So we target these micro small businesses. We provide them with the technology platform that allows them to provide services to end consumers, the largest being money transfers. So we've got a network of about 400 of these small businesses across Zambia that are branded in Zona's colors. Consumers can come and into these shops and send and receive money transfers from one point to the other, and then the shops use a mobile phone as a point of sale to do the transaction on our platform, and they earn a commission every time they do the transaction. We've then added other services such as the ability to send prepaid airtime, the ability to pay their suppliers to stock Coca-Cola and other products in their shop. And then it started as a payment platform, and then we make money every time that there's a transaction that's processed. So we charge the person who's sending the money transfer fee, and then, you know, we get part of that as our revenue, and then we share it as part of it as commission to our customers as these small, micro, and small enterprises. And then we've also added a financial service component where we started providing them with working capital in the form of either longer or medium to longer term loans to expand, to open new outlets or new shop or build their working capital base, and also short term financing so that they have overdraft facilities to continue with having more float or more stock. And in a nutshell, we provide these business solutions, and it's been something that we've been getting increasingly better at, and have grown the business now to the point where we're processing about $20 million per month in Zambia in payment value. We've got about 60 employees spread across our Zambia and Cape Town offices, and are really gearing up to expand into new countries. And we've kind of got the honor of being the first startup technology business out of Zambia to ever attract international venture capital. So we closed a $4 million Series A equity round with the Omidyar Network and Axion Frontier Funds back in early 2012, and have been really accelerating the business since that day.
The vast majority of people in Zambia don't have bank accounts. I mean, what impact does that have on economic development?
Out of the network, I said we've got about 400 of these micro and small enterprises, but they're servicing, about 350,000 to 400,000 customers per month that are doing these money transfer transactions at their shops. And 80% plus of those end customers don't have bank accounts. And the reason why they use our services is because it is so difficult to move money from point A to point B in Zambia. You take it for granted in a developed country where you get your salary paid into your bank account every month through direct debit, just automatically deposited in your account. You can then, if you need to send money to somebody, you just do a banking transfer or an EFT. But if you've never had a bank account, you get paid in cash. To then move money to a relative who could be in a different town. People physically have to move cash from point A to point B, and they do that either through like a minibus or a taxi, where they'll give money to somebody to move that cash. There is a government institutional post office that you can send money, but it can take a long time to get there, and it's not always reliable, and it's not always open, and it's quite expensive to do. So it's very, very expensive and often not even safe to move money. Like you'll find people, you could be a business trader where you need to go and import goods from a border, and people will actually move with large amounts of cash on them on a bus, and they risk being robbed and just the worry of having to move with cash. While they go and buy goods, people sleep with cash under their mattresses all of the time. So it's a very, kind of almost primitive economic environment at a household level where, everything is done in cash, and it's not dissimilar to like the UK or Canada would have been, a few decades back before there were bank cards and ATM machines everywhere. But now with the explosion of mobile phones, where everybody has a mobile phone and you can use a mobile phone as like a point of sale, which our agents do. And suddenly, our business model means that anybody who has a mobile phone and has a little bit of cash as working capital to transact as float can essentially become an ATM machine and provide a financial service to all of people within their communities that can just walk up to them and then needs to, we are able to move money from one part of a country to a completely different part of the country instantly, and our technology enables that to happen.
Wow. And I suppose linked to this is the idea, of the importance of, I suppose, what you call micro-entrepreneurs and so forth. How important are they in Zambia for economic growth?
These micro and small enterprises, micro-entrepreneurs, as you say, We consider them our core customer, and they make our entire business possible. And so, there is a growing formal sector and middle class in markets like Zambia, and you do have shopping malls popping up and large like chain stores out of South Africa primarily. But the huge bulk of the economy is just these mom and pop shops, and even the end consumers that we're servicing, a lot of people are sending money for entrepreneurial activities because they might be, they're paying somebody that they bought goods from, and then they sell, they sell those goods as sole proprietorships. And, I quoted that $20 million per month of value that we're able to move across the economy. It's these really small businesses that are, are doing that and servicing these customers, and they're the ones that are creating employment too. So it's like they're really a driver of the economy of enabling financial services, of creating employment within their, you know, their single shops and then branching out into new shops. And it's just a critical engine that we think we can really make a big contribution to actually move economic growth in a country like Zambia, but do it in a way that is a small entrepreneur that has a business opportunity and is able to capitalize on that.
Right. And I guess you mentioned the relationship with Kiva, but is it in some ways what you're doing? I mean, how similar is it to microfinance, which I think many people are familiar with?
Yeah. Well, microfinance, the traditional model was that came to Africa was like a group lending model with microfinance institutions that would give small loans to individuals as part of a group structure, and then those individuals would use the microfinance loan for primarily business activities and buying and selling goods and trading. And so our focus at Zona is providing the financing similar to microfinance, but to small businesses and to primarily individual micro entrepreneurs. So we don't do any group lending, which is one of the differences. And then because we have a technology platform, we're able to give the financing to these small micro entrepreneurs on the back of the transactions that they're doing to service consumers in Zambia. We know every single transaction that they do because it's on our system. There's an electronic log of it. We know their commissions and the cash flows that they make. And then we can disperse and receive funds electronically. So we have the benefit of not needing to have a kind of traditional loan officers that need to understand. We don't even need to use a group environment or a group dynamic to lend these people money because we actually just have all of the data from the transactions that they're doing, and we can lend businesses funds on the back of their actual real cash flows. And then in order to take that down to a consumer level, like right now the businesses we lend to that just provides a service to end consumers, but we do envision one day seeing an opportunity to then push that credit down to a consumer level where we know every time a customer comes and sends a money transfer to an agent, and to be able to identify which of those customers are doing it the most frequently, and then providing, you know, whether it's financing or other products to help them, join the financial inclusive community, is an opportunity that we see for the future.
Sounds great. I mean, clearly, this is such economic impact beyond the individuals involved, because the money, I guess, multiplies around in people's hands and stimulates further economic activity. I'm just wondering about, you mentioned the studying and doing this, getting very involved in the whole area of social entrepreneurship. I suppose, to what extent is this, would you characterize this as a social entrepreneurial business? And, how does that play out in how you approach the growing the business?
I think that's a great question. And I think it, what we are doing at the heart of it is on one hand, it's very much like pure kind of social entrepreneurship, but on the other hand, it's also like it's a commercial enterprise, and we consider ourselves kind of entrepreneurs first and social entrepreneurs second, and we want to make money out of this, and that's a kind of a key driver to what I actually believe has made us successful and will continue to make us successful and really pursue creating things that can scale. And the best definition of entrepreneurship that I've come across is the relentless pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. And everything we have done has been consistent to that of we think that there's a huge market opportunity to provide these financial services and these, you know, these business solutions to micro small businesses, to consumers in Africa, to even corporates that are transacting with these consumers and small businesses, and to do it in a way that makes money and makes and generates profit for everybody in the value chain. Because that's the way that actually is going to scale and have the biggest impact and attract the most investment and help us, you know, build a sustainable business that we are attracting good talent into our organization, paying people fair wages, so forth. But on the social enterprise thing side of the coin, everything we do is trying to, you know, to solve that problem for somebody that does need to move money from point A to point B for medicine or for school fees, or for the providing financing to that small entrepreneur that has a business idea and has a small shop, but actually just does not have access to financial services to have enough working capital to scale his business, or to hire that other person. And so that aspect is, you know, very much at the root is a social enterprise of where we sit. It doesn't really fit neatly into a category, but it's kind of by nature of the market that we operate in Zambia and then the customer segment that we're going after, the social aspect has to be key to our goal and our value set as a company. And so we take that very, very seriously. But, you know, if we believe that if we weren't pursuing profit and trying to make money, we would actually potentially be going down a wrong path and not be able to achieve the impact and the scale that we want to. So we try to kind of balance that very, very carefully. And like I said, the simplest kind of rule is commercial for-profit business first, social enterprise second.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's a kind of an umbrella term, isn't it, really? And it includes all kinds of organizations, I suppose, with a different mix of pure commercial and social and triple bottom line and so forth, objectives in many different forms. It's interesting you feel very strongly about the profit side of things, and to the extent that if you weren't making a profit that you'd be going down the wrong path. Could you elucidate a little bit on that?
I've worked with a number of nonprofits in my life, and kind of that was a background that I came from, I'm trying to find the words, but everybody's kind of aware of the challenges in the aid sector and the kind of top down approach of providing charity and a lot of the challenges that comes and I believe that there is a lot of really good work that nonprofits and charities and donor organizations but at the end of the day, I think one of our core values is just entrepreneurship, and I really believe, and our business and team really believe that, enabling real entrepreneurs, not necessarily entrepreneurs that are starting huge organizations that you might find in the West, but like micro entrepreneurs, people that do want to grow from being single shop owners to managing multiple shops and employing more people, and at the end of the day, they're motivated by more money in their pocket at the end of the month, and being able to make a life for themselves and be successful at what they do, but also having enough at the end of the month to support their families, to send their kids to school, even to send their kids away to school sometimes. Because if you grow up in places like Zambia, like kids, like parents might dream of sending their children to educational institutions like Oxford University in the UK, like I had the privilege of going through. So I find it hugely motivating to work to enable people who have kind of that, those motivations and help them build their businesses. And in order for us to really understand their challenges, like we need to organizations, and that profit motive is a big part of it. So, you know, it's just, it's kind of who we are. It's in our DNA, in my DNA. And at the end of the day, one great piece of advice I heard once is if somebody is willing to pay for your service, it is an absolutely fantastic indicator that you are creating value, and they, you know, they are willing to actually transfer some of that value to you because, you know, they're willing to take money out of their pocket and give it to you. So I'm not saying it's a blanket approach, and it's kind of the solution to, you know, failed aid approaches and things like that, but it's certainly one approach that I think is important. And I mentioned before, like, one of our big audacious goals is becoming a billion-dollar business, and to be able to do that, to say, like, we started it in Zambia, and we were able to build a successful business in Zambia, and we were able to scale it into multiple countries and to hire people and to create value that is servicing, you know, millions of customers one day. The story that I think that can tell to investors, to other entrepreneurs that are thinking of similar ideas, to people who do graduate from universities in places like Zambia and want to become entrepreneurs themselves or work for fast growing companies, just to know that it's possible in Africa is something that I find very motivating.
That's certainly a great story, and one I think which would inspire Zambian social entrepreneurs.
You talked about this question, the idea of scaling. It's a challenging proposition in any environment, I think, to, you know, scale an organization to, you know, a pure entrepreneurial organization or a startup business in a developed market, as it were. In an emerging market, in somewhere like Zambia, I can imagine even more challenging. And when you look at social businesses and so forth, I think that's something that many people often say is, you know, that why aren't there bigger, more ambitious, more successful social businesses which are, you know, having a bigger impact? How important do you think this question of scalability is?
Yeah, I really believe it's critical. You're exactly right. There's very few scalable social business models that you can point to, and they're hard to find, and it's one of the reasons is it's hard to do, and you do have a number of challenges in emerging markets that are tougher than you would have in a Western market, and two keys to that is one is capital. And one of the areas that we've been quite successful is been able to attract investment from this new class of investors called impact investors, and the likes of the OVR Network and Axion Frontiers, which are our two kind of lead investors. So there are these new funds and institutions that are popping up that have specific mandates to put early stage venture capital into emerging market countries like Zambia and in businesses like ours. And without that capital, it's very easy to fizzle out. Because in our early days, like, we were running out of money all the time. We were really struggling to make payroll. And luckily, we were able to kind of go long enough and get enough traction to attract traction to attract this investment, and then that really kind of released the floodgates, where when we had money in the bank, suddenly you can start thinking a little bit more strategically, a little bit more long term, and then chase the bigger opportunities and focus on scale. Whereas if you're a small business, it's great to say, hey, like, we want to scale, but if at the end of the month you can't pay your salaries, it's really hard to get there. So that's one major challenge, and then another major challenge to scale, I think, is just attracting like top talent. So, you know, if you're a Silicon Valley startup in the United States, you have Harvard and Stanford MBAs and students and top graduates in the world that will work for you for free or for equity options, or just due to do internships. Whereas in countries like Zambia, you don't have that deep talent pool, so you have to get by with less kind of talent at your disposal. And often, the good people people in these markets are quite expensive because there is such a shortage of talent that you're competing as a startup with the banks and the government and large organizations like the World Bank maybe that do pay very, very good for top managers. So you're kind of starting against the grain. On the upside, in emerging markets, you do have huge opportunities everywhere. And that's the really exciting thing because you can kick over a stone and think of a new business idea and so there's no shortage of opportunity, and then there's often there is a shortage of competition a lot of the time, so you can find kind of market failures or things that nobody's doing very well, and you know, like the Western environments, that might be more difficult because every time you have a business idea, you might find three or four other people who are doing the same thing at the same time. So it's just kind of a different set of initial conditions to starting a business. But then, you know, to scale a company, it's really, really hard, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of support, and you know, most companies fail. You only read about the success stories and see, you know, everybody knows about the Google and the Facebook, but there's only, you know, there's one Google and there's one Facebook, and there's a lot of other people that have probably tried to do that and aren't around anymore. So it's, you know, just having the persistence, that relentless pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. Like, it's a technical kind of jargony definition, but it's like that's what entrepreneurship is, and it's hard to get right, and something that's taken us 5 years to get to a point where we just feel like we're now approaching the starting point almost, even though we have been going for this period.
Well, I think that's a very helpful way of looking at the question of scaling up a social business.
What about some of the challenges you have faced? You mentioned, you know, financial challenges, working capital and so forth as you've grown. Have there been some difficult days? Were there times you thought this may not succeed? How have you kept going? Inspired.
Yeah, I think there's been three very distinct phases in our business life cycle I can draw on. In the early days, for the first couple of years, it was just pure survival. So we were like, and the good news is as most entrepreneurs will tell you, those are the days when you're the most naive. So you always think you're kind of just about to have this super success. And you know, it's almost looking like it's an attainable achievement, but then, you know, 5 years on, I look back and say, oh wow, we really didn't know what we were doing at the time. You know, the first couple of years, it was really just about trying to make payroll, you know, being faced with looking, saying, okay, hey, today's March 12th, and saying, okay, we've got 2 weeks to make payroll and we're $40,000 short. You know, those kind of conversations, like, what do you do in those situations? And I remember one instance of having to, you know, to go back to all my staff, like the week before Christmas, tell everybody that they're getting a pay cut. Two people that had just joined us a week before, I had to essentially lay them off. And those were really, really hard times and difficult, and, you know, difficult decisions and conversations, but there was no other options. And we were able to kind of scrape and pull rabbits out of hats on getting customers to pay us early, finding a little bit of investment, getting some, you know, reaching into our personal networks to get angel investment, doing a lot of projects that we didn't want to do that we knew were bad projects strategy-wise and were distracting, but it's, you know, we didn't have a choice because we just needed to get cash. So that was kind of phase one, and then that allowed us to continue kind of building the business and getting enough traction where we were able to start raising the attention of investors, and then we went through this year-long fundraising process and were able to close this $4 million kind of venture capital round in early 2012. And then we entered a new phase where it was initially, I think, a false sense of security where we had all of this money in our bank account and you know, we gave everybody raises and did things that everybody tells you shouldn't do when you get new investment, but it's really hard not to. Then we kind of looked a few months on and had a wake-up call, and we were literally like burning through about $250,000 of cash per month. And so to come from a very frugal environment where you're not making payroll, to saying like, holy, like how can you quickly ramp up and end up spending that much money, you know, by just hiring new people, and the, you know, the it's a big leap of faith because the revenue hadn't come yet. You take on all of this new expense, and you're growing, you're trying to grow quickly, but you actually, you know, don't know that the revenue is going to come. And so we had the second phase where when we kind of started getting our heads around that and went back to the principles of being a bit more frugal and really just focusing the business on okay, now we need to become cash flow positive again. And you know, we went on then after the initial hiring spree, we had a hiring freeze, and said, you know, we're not going to spend any more money until we can get the revenues to catch up. And it's all about, like in a Silicon Valley environment, you might just blow the money knowing that there's other investors that as long as you get user growth and traction, people will give you more money. But, you know, as a business in Africa, you can't be guaranteed that. And you might not find the money. You might not get it on the terms you want. So we really wanted to get back in charge of our own destiny, and we were able to do that, and we're now entering this third phase, which is you know, it's almost a bigger challenge because it's now that we've proven ourselves as a business and we've got something that is valuable. A, we don't want to lose it, but B, I think we're all terrified of not being as successful as we want to be. So we're very much driven a little bit by, I think, a fear of failure of saying we put the stake in the ground that we want to build this billion-dollar Pan-African business. We think we have a technology and a model that can scale everywhere, but you know, we don't know yet, and we haven't been able to prove outside of Zambia. And we have a lot of other products that we're testing in the markets that haven't taken off, and we've hired a lot of people and putting a lot of resources into doing this. So it's now a big strategic challenge of saying, you know, is our model the right one? Is the market the right place? Do we have the right pieces and to the puzzle, and can we really build something that creates kind of the impact that we think is possible, and we believe is possible. So that's the challenge we're facing now.
Wow! And how do you keep going when times are tough? what inspires you?
Yeah, I think I have to start from personal perspective. Is like I've got a wonderful wife that I met in the UK and has kind of followed me along this journey and you know, paid in the early days, paid the rent and kept the lights on, and I've got a 15-month-old daughter, so that's kind of my sanctuary when I get home from work, and it's really, really important to have that, because you know, when you're working 18-hour days in the early days and you're faced with these challenges all the time, to have kind of some personal you know, support is really important. Second of all, I think my business partners and Brad and Brett, and as kind of the founding entrepreneurs, like you get energy from each other is really, really important. So like I could never imagine being a founding entrepreneur without a team and without partners. And some people do it, but I think it's been really important that like I've found people that have similar values and goals, but very complementary skills. Sets. It's been a big success, and that like now we're at the size where we have 60 employees, and we're, you know, we're hiring. We're going to scale up to about 100 by the end of this year, so we're hiring quite aggressively. And each new person you bring on board, it's you know, that's it's adding a piece to your family, and it's a livelihood for that person, and you get to a fun part of my job is I get to spend a lot of time now trying to identify what the talents of our new employees are, and then trying to find ways to unlock them. And then you actually start seeing this thing that you've been building and was really close to your chest in the early days, but now it's letting it go and letting other people you know, add to the story and seeing where they can take it. And you know, our business is now bigger than any one individual or just the founding entrepreneurial team. And so I get a huge amount of motivation from that. And then probably lastly is just knowing it's possible and it's done. Like you have these great stories of entrepreneurial giants out of Silicon Valley in the U.S. and, you know, in the U.K. and you know, why, like, there are these stories in Africa, and why can't it be us? And that's kind of a challenge that I have always thrown back to the team, you know, of saying, you know, that nobody in the grand scheme of things, Zambia is a small country, but hey, like, every business has to start somewhere, and if we can build a business model in Zambia, well, you know, surely in Malawi and Tanzania and Mozambique and the DRC, and, you know, you can just name all of these, like, Zambia has 8 neighboring countries, and we know that the challenges faced in those countries are contextually and culturally different, but at the end of the day, for small businesses, for people moving money around, it's fundamentally the same problems that we're trying to solve. So if we can build solutions that can work in a place like Zambia, there's a lot of countries like Zambia that it can work in, and, you know, we'll never take our model to Europe, but you know, the emerging markets is a huge, huge opportunity for a company like ours, and it's a very exciting thing to be a part of.
Ah. Sounds very exciting, and underlying this, I guess, is this I think you call them big, hairy, audacious goals. Can you talk a little bit about you know, the importance of goals and the importance of big goals?
That's a great question, because I think you will find very different perspectives to that question, and to the point where I have been told point blank that, Mike, stop saying that you'll be a billion-dollar business. That's a silly thing to say. It's the wrong goal to focus on. And you know, and I've heard other people say, if you don't say it, you'll never achieve it. Right? So you have to like, I'm a big believer in these big, hairy, audacious goals. But I also really, really believe that we can achieve that. So I think the trick is setting a big goal, but that goal has to be achievable. And it's, you know, what that means is going to be different for the market that you're in, the business that you're building. And you know, what this essentially a goal does is it aligns everybody around the same thing, but it more importantly, I think it attracts and filters out the you know, attracts the right people and filters out the wrong people. By you know, putting this goal out of saying, okay, Zona, we want to be a billion-dollar Pan-African business, we've built a management team that believes that we can achieve that and that has that scale in mind from the get-go, and then the people that are you know, we're thinking, hey, well, you know, we're just comfortable being part of a small business. They've exited from the organization, and it just wasn't the right fit for them. And so now we've been able to kind of get a group of people together that, you know, initially it was me kind of just banging on this drum, but then, you know, getting our management team to believe in it, and now everybody that joins the organization, people are saying that they want to work with us because they see the vision that this company has. And so that's been a really, really important part of our growth story. And, you know, like, again, just to reiterate, I think you have to believe it, and it has to be achievable, or else you're setting yourselves up to failure. And that's the hard part that I think, like, as a, it's a leap of faith that you have to make as an entrepreneur. But for us, it was the right goal, and it still is the right goal. And you know, and like, I really believe we can get there. So that's why we've set it.
Wow, that's wonderful. That's a great goal, and it's certainly an ambitious one. Going back maybe just for a moment to an earlier stage of growth and development, and talking to, you know, social entrepreneurs, I mean, entrepreneurs in general, but I think particularly social entrepreneurs who struggle, I suppose, with having role models maybe, or maybe having support from like-minded people who like-minded entrepreneurs maybe who have had experience or understand the challenge of building a business, maybe in a difficult environment, but also realizing, you know, big social goals. And it's a very particular challenge, I think. What kind of support have you had?
Yeah, It's critical. I have personally benefited tremendously from the networks that I built when I kind of was studying at LSE in Oxford, and you know, both from just people from my class, but also like other entrepreneurs that kind of came out of those networks that I can rely on, but probably more importantly from some personal mentors I've been able to find. I heard a quote once, just from I think an article I read, that it's like one of the most important challenges an entrepreneur faces is who to listen to for advice. Because what you'll find is everybody has an opinion, and it's really, really easy to be a consultant or an armchair critic and say, hey, the businesses should do this, or these are the decisions you should make. But it's really, really precious to find like those one or two people that have done it before, or you know, whether they're in a corporate environment or they've been an entrepreneur before, and can actually give you advice and help you navigate the minefield along the way in the journey. And so we had in the early days found an advisor that, you know, was a past entrepreneur and CEO, and he helped really put together, really build the relationships between myself and the two founders, and then structure an agreement between the three of us, because you're dealing with a lot of like really difficult conversations at the time around splitting equity and you know, investing personal cash, and those are really, really hard things, because the two guys that started the company, they were brothers as well, that I had to really figure out how to work with. And so he helped structure that agreement, and then really helped think about like how to raise investment, because I'd never done it before. And the first time we got a term sheet from an investment fund, like I thought it was great. And then he pointed out all the ways that we were giving up control of our business, and the huge kind of pitfalls that if we had taken that deal would have resulted. So having somebody that had done that before was really instrumental. And then I had a couple of other personal advisors that have been just very good mentors to me, that I can call and ask for advice and on business advice, on personal advice, and it's really hard to get. I think in order to get that, you need to make your own luck, because the busy people and the people you want advice from, a lot of people want to, you know, contribute and mentor people, but you know they're busy. They're not just going to solicit or respond to unsolicited emails. So you need to have a kind of a personal relationship with people, and you know, through networking, and then just be very persistent. Like one of my personal mentors, who's kind of in a senior position at Google, was somebody that I was, you know, in the early days, just persistently hassling around how exciting our business was, and it was like after the sixth or seventh time of, and he probably was seeing our numbers go up every time I was sending him these offers. Finally, you know, he said, "Hey, I would be interested in having a phone call with you," and then and was able to even invest a small amount of money into our business in the early days. So. It's hard, but you have to find those people. I've found them very helpful.
That's very interesting. That's something certainly that many social entrepreneurs have emphasized, the importance of a strong support team, and indeed the value of persistence.
If you're thinking about other entrepreneurs, you know, wanting to build, you know, effective businesses in challenging environments, like I suppose in parts of Africa and so forth that don't have the infrastructure, what would you say?
Yeah, I think, well, two pieces of advice at the simplest level I can give is probably, A, just start, but B, you have to be committed. One of my personal foundations is when I got on the plane from Oxford to Zambia, and this is where, like, having kind of my personal support network with the time I wasn't married, but with my fiance, and, you know, she had actually grown up in West Africa, and we had made a very concerted effort to move, and we didn't have a time limit, and we said, you know, we're going here to do this, and I didn't know what I was going to find at the time, but you know, we were prepared to see it through. And like through our business, and even through early business partners I had, like I've seen it time and time again. Of it's a really exciting idea to come to Africa and to be an entrepreneur and to start a business. But at the end of the day, it's like it's easy to be there for 2 years. It's hard to be there for 10. And I think if you're starting a business and you're serious, you need to be prepared up front to make the commitment for 10 years, because that's, you know, you might fail after 2 years and decide, hey, I'm going to do something else. But if you do start picking up the pace, you need to be prepared to kind of take the responsibility that comes with it. But then it's never too late or too early to start something. I think it's really scary to make that that big leap, that first leap of faith. But if you do, generally good things happen. So and then beyond that, it's kind of the rest is details. But those are kind of the two most important things, I think.
Well, excellent. That's been a very inspiring conversation, and lots of good, hard-won wisdom and advice from building your business. And wish you the very best of success with your continued growth. Thank you for that.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur Podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.